And Racine, 61 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information available on all that Carthage offers at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. A little later on, we're going to be hearing from the CEO of the National Wildlife Federation, but we're going to begin with Fabrice Conte-Williamson, who is a member of the theater faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, right up the road from us. And we're going to be talking with him about a production that is about to open at UW Parkside and to run the next two weekends, October 15, 16, 17, and October 22nd and 23rd. It is the play The Penelopiad by Margaret Atwood, which is a retelling of the famous Greek myth of the Odyssey, but through the eyes or from the perspective of the wife of Odysseus, Penelope. And what an intriguing idea from the brilliant mind of Margaret Atwood. And I'm so excited that we can talk about this production that is about to open tomorrow night. Fabrice Conte-Williamson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Remind me what we talked about when you were here previously on the morning show, if you remember.
I do remember. This was my first few months in Wisconsin. I just moved from Oklahoma to Wisconsin. I was directing the War of the Worlds, the radio show for UW Parkside. It was my first production here.
Very good. Well, I'm excited to talk with you about this. I must confess I had never, ever heard of this this work. I mean, I've heard of the Odyssey, of course, but not of the Penelopiad, but from what I have read, this is actually quite a big deal and one of a number of amazing things created by Margaret Atwood. Is this something that more of us should know something about?
Well, probably. We should know more about literature in general, but we were looking at producing a Greek tragedy as part of the season this year, so because we haven't done one in a while. And a member of our faculty, Leslie Vaglica, who's the new costume shop manager at Parkside, suggested to read this adaptation of Margaret Atwood's novel, and Atwood also adapted it into a play. And she thought, oh, this could be a good project both for the students and for our audience to get a little bit of the Greek mythology, the Greek stories, but also a contemporary text. And so I read it, and I fell in love with it. I thought it was so interesting, in particular, like you pointed out, because it is providing a different perspective on a story that many of us know already, the Odyssey. And it just is very thought-provoking.
One of the things that it made me wonder about is that all kinds of notable women are part of Greek mythology, but almost never are they the primary figures, nor are they the primary storytellers. They are not the tellers of their own stories the way that this work by Margaret Atwood is. That is primarily about Penelope and told from her perspective. Is this, in a sense, kind of a first, as far as you know?
It might be. What Atwood does, which is I think really interesting is not only she's giving Penelope a voice, Penelope just says, I think there's a line to the effect of, this is my version of the story, and here I am and I'm going to tell you, but also she's giving a voice to the 12 maids who in the Odyssey get murdered when Odysseus returns from the Trojan War. And so there is another competing narrative of, well, maybe we are going to hear from the queen and from what she has to say, but also from these voices that are completely erased. The maids that are getting hung. So it's multi-layered, which is also fascinating in terms of the production, because yes, we are hearing from Penelope, but we are also hearing from her slaves.
Interesting. Any of our listeners and me as well, who are probably rusty on our Greek mythology, what the basic story of the Odyssey is. And I, from what I understand, the Penelopiad is roughly the same story, just retold. But remind us just a little bit about that original work.
So the Odyssey offers, it's a long epic poem, so it offers all the episodes of Odysseus going to the Trojan War and coming back to Ithaca. In the Penelopiad, we see Penelope getting married, her childhood. She tells us about how she met Odysseus in the first place and how she's taken to Ithaca. And then when her husband leaves to go to war, to go to the Trojan War, or is going to fight, she has to wait for his return, which lasts many, many, many years. And so she hears about the different episodes that Odysseus is going through as he tries to return to Ithaca. And then she deals with her own issues, which are first and foremost suitors who are trying to make her marry them so they can become king of Ithaca in case Odysseus doesn't return. So there's a lot of intrigues in the in the play, and it's quite interesting. There's a lot of humor in the play, but also some serious moments that go along with Greek mythology.
Right. Remind us why Odysseus, upon his return, has these 12 handmaidens hung. What does he accuse them of?
So Penelope wants to hold the suitors at bay because she believes Odysseus will be returning. And so she comes up with a scheme to weave a shroud with her maids for her father-in-law. And she tells the suitors, when the shroud is finished, then I will choose somebody to marry. And at night, they unweave the shroud so it never gets finished. The maids are also asked to flirt and entertain the suitors all along to also, delay them in their pursuit of Penelope. Telemachus, who is Odysseus's son, witnesses all of this is really offended that his mother seems to entertain this court of maids and suitors in debauchery. And so the father decides, when he returns, to have everybody killed, the suitors and the maids, for their behavior. He doesn't know that Penelope was just trying to save their marriage, I guess.
Wow. And what about then the reunion of Odysseus and Penelope?
Well, the very end of the production, and this is not a spoiler, because if you know the myth, you already know that Odysseus does return. We hear from Penelope a little bit about what happens once Odysseus returns and how that plays out, and how she compromises between what she knows as the truth, which is that the maids were helping her, and the reality that the maids get murdered.
So she has to sort of take that in and decide whether or not to
Correct.
Accept that and in a sense, forgive Odysseus for what he has done. If I remember correctly, when the curtain goes up or the lights come up as the play begins, Penelope is in Hades.
Correct.
So why is she there?
Well, Penelope and pretty much all the characters at the beginning of the play are already dead. And so
they've just died of natural
They
causes.
Have died. Yeah. And so we hear from them from Hades, so from the underworld, throughout the story. And then we go back and forth between the story of the myth and back in Hades, on and off, where the maids are haunting Penelope and Odysseus for what has happened to them.
We're speaking today with Fabrice Conte-Williamson about the University of Wisconsin-Parkside's production of the Penelopiad, a novella by Margaret Atwood, which she adapted then into a stage work, and that is opening tomorrow night at UW-Parkside. So this is a retelling of these well-known stories from the Odyssey. What would you say is the nature of the retelling? I mean, first of all, are any of the events in the Odyssey substantively altered, or is it that they are just described in a very different way from a very different perspective? And how about in matters of, for instance, language also? How different is this from the original?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, the story of the Odyssey is in the background because we really stay with Penelope and what happens to her rather than follow Odysseus in his, on his journey. So we get to see sort of the backstage version of the Odyssey, if you will. I think because there's a shift in the narrative, then we definitely have a different perspective on the Odyssey, which is very much of a patriarchal view of the events. And then suddenly we have a woman's perspective, and also what I also find really interesting is the perspective of the slaves who do get to interact with Penelope and with the audience throughout the show. When it comes to the language, what's really fascinating about Margaret Atwood is she's such a poet that even in the dramatic form, there's a lot of poetry. There is songs. We have original music composed by Kevin Gray, who's one of our faculty member, who's created all these songs for the show. As you know, the author gives you this poem, and you have to put it to music. So that's been a really fun collaborative process to imagine the musical landscape of the show with another theater artist and for our students to kind of be part of this process where you have to create the music within 5 weeks.
So in the script, there are these moments where one presumes these words will be sung, and then it is left up to each production to come up with the music for that.
That's exactly right. Yes. Huh. So it is a challenge.
Right. My understanding is that the interjections of these 12 maidens is a particularly distinctive part of this work in terms of what they have to say and how they say it.
Yes. So the 12 maids function, for anybody who knows Greek theater, you know, ancient Greek tragedy, for example, the 12 maids function like the Greek chorus. So they come in as interludes in some way between the scenes of retelling of the myth or what Penelope was doing while she was waiting for Odysseus, and they demand different things, and they interact either with the audience asking some questions about their fate and what is justice, things like that, in the form of poems most often. Either those poems are put to music or they are spoken and have been worked in different ways and staged in different ways to really make them stand out. In contrast with the scenes of dialogues and more traditional drama. And the maids provide most of the spectacle in the show because they dance and they sing and they have all different kinds of movement work that has been included in the production. So it might seem the most odd things to read when you're reading these pages of poetry in the middle of the play. But then when you stage it, there is so much opportunity for spectacle that it becomes really exciting.
So, for instance, is Odysseus in this play? I mean, do we physically see him on the stage? How much of a role does he play?
Yeah, so the 12 maids play all the characters outside of Penelope. So we have a cast of 13. Penelope plays Penelope, and then the 12 maids play all the other characters in the story. So we do get to see Odysseus, we get to see Telemachus, their son, and we get to see all the other characters that are part of the Odyssey, many of them. And then those actors go back and forth between the different characters that they play. This is an interesting aspect of the work from the author, is that it invites for a constantly shifting narrative where people tell the story from a character's point of view, and then they switch from a different character. So it's quite fun to watch and see the actors transform throughout the show.
Right. So how would you characterize Margaret Atwood's language? And I mean, does this feel like the words of 2005, or does this feel like something closer to the words of ancient Greece, or interesting amalgamation?
Yeah, it's a great fusion, I think, of both. She's such a wonderful writer, and there's so much humor and contemporary, you know, little references that I think a contemporary audience will really enjoy. But also the language is still heightened in places. And so we do get that feeling of heightened ritualistic drama at the same time as you get to see sort of this upset Penelope having to negotiate her husband's absence and with the humor of today.
Hmm. This is happening in Parkside's Black Box Theater, which is a really extraordinary space. I've seen some amazing things there. Tell us visually what this production is going to look like.
So the production is in the Black Box Theater in a thrust configuration, so with audiences on three sides. Really lucky because we get to welcome back a live audience for the first time in many months.
Yeah.
So we're looking forward to that. And last year we were streaming and doing multi-camera work, and it was a whole different adventure.
Yeah.
So we're welcoming back our live audience. When you walk in the space, you'll see this really interesting set designed by Jody Sikas, who's one of my colleagues at Parkside, who's created this interesting space that could be from a very long ago past or the future. It's in sort of this timeless design, very exciting set to work on as a director. And the lighting design is by Jessica Baker, who's a last year student who has won multiple awards with the Kennedy Center American College Theater Festival. And this is going to be her final production with us.
Oh.
So I'm enjoying greatly to work with Jessica. We did War of the Worlds together.
Hmm.
Our actors are going through COVID-19 testing, and so they'll be able to perform unmasked, and we're so excited for them. So student actors get to really practice what they learn, and we're asking our audiences to stay masked during the performance.
Mm-hmm. What has been most challenging about working on this production for you as the director? What kind of maybe vexing choices have you faced in terms of kind of bringing this unconventional work to life?
Well, director Anne Bogart has this wonderful little article that she titles Violence, and it's all about making choices, right? When this moment where you have to make a choice which eliminates all the other choices.
Ah.
And so when you create something so collaborative where you have to devise a lot of what the show will look like and what do you do with these poems and all this good stuff, there's a certain violent act when you say this is the way we're going to do it and we're committing to this particular take. So I think for as a director, this is both exciting and challenging. There's so many possibilities with a text so open to interpretation, to what it could look like, how it could be performed. But I really enjoy that. And I think our students also really enjoyed working on a different kind of play, different kind of project that called for their artistic input at every single rehearsal, where we try to devise different ways to do, to stage and bring to life these stories and these moments of theater.
Hmm. So we are recording this actually on Wednesday, and you are about to open. People are hearing this on Thursday, and you are opening on Friday night then and running for two performances. For those who are in the cast, what kind of how taxing is this? I mean, is this a demanding play sort of emotionally and mentally for your performers?
I think it's definitely physically very demanding for the performers because, as I said, they are basically on stage the whole time. They play all the characters. They run around. They transform into different characters for every scene. And they dance and they sing and they have a lot to do. So I know the actors are preparing physically to sustain the show for the two weekend of performances. Because they're student actors, so of course they're still learning, they're still training.
Still have geometry tests.
That's right. And so we want to protect that, of course. But I know for them that it's been a challenge physically, and I don't know about emotionally. I think our actors are trained not to, you know, to differentiate between their own emotional journey and that of the characters. But I know for a fact that they really are excited about getting a live audience back in the theater, because they've missed that so much last year, only being, you know, seen on film. We were making films last year.
Right. Yeah. That was a laudable, commendable thing to do that lots of places did. But of course, it's not live theater. It's drastically different, and a drastically different experience for viewer and performers alike. And so, yes, it is so good to return to the norm of live theater once again. So this is the first production then of Parkside's newest season.
That's right. The first full production, we're starting with the Penelopea. Then we'll have the Thanksgiving play, which is a comedy coming up in November. And then next semester, we'll have Indecent by Paula Vogel and She Kills Monsters, which is a great spectacle play that will be our last production of the year.
In the meantime, we direct people to the website of UW Parkside, which is uwp.edu. Anything fancier in terms of securing tickets?
Sure. You can reserve your tickets. They're free this semester, which is awesome, just so we can welcome back our audiences. But you can reserve your ticket at uwp.edu/therita, so T-H-E-R-I-T-A.
Very good. Fabrice Conte-Williamson, the director of the Penelopiad by Margaret Atwood. Thank you for being here. The best wishes to you and all who are involved in this production.
Thanks for having me.
And here comes part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. In this portion of WGTD's morning show, we are connecting with Colin O'Mara, who is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. We're going to talk briefly about the overall work and mission of the National Wildlife Federation, and then we're going to be talking about the advocacy which they are doing on behalf of certain tenants that are part of the Build Back Better Act that is currently being considered on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., a reconciliation process involving the infrastructure package, and they are concerned in particular about several what they are calling climate-forward provisions that they think are very, very important and that they hope will remain in place through this process. And we're going to be talking through some of those tenets that they are concerned about. Colin O'Mara, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, thanks for having me on today.
How long have you been with the National Wildlife Federation?
God, it's been almost 6 years. I feel like I'm too young to say that, but I had served as natural resource secretary in the state of Delaware for a while beforehand, and I was a Ranger Rick kid growing up. So when the headhunter called, I couldn't pass it down. It's the opportunity to serve the Federation.
I can see how that would fold nicely into some of your interests. Give our listeners some sense of the overall mission of the National Wildlife Federation.
Yeah, and so the National Wildlife Federation's goal is to unite all Americans to make sure wildlife can thrive in our rapidly changing world. And we are a true federation. We have affiliates in all 50 states, and Wisconsin, it's the Great Wisconsin Wildlife Federation. And our goal is to bring people together, you know, kind of across party lines, across regions, to say that there's an important place for nature, there's an important place for, you know, clean air and clean water and healthy habitats, and that, you know, when we save wildlife, we save ourselves, and that, you know, whether you love to go hunting and fishing or just, you know, like to spend time outdoors, hiking or gardening or canoeing or kayaking, that it's important that we have healthy natural resources for the benefit of all people.
What would be the primary ways in which the National Wildlife Federation goes about working towards those goals?
Yeah, so we do a combination of advocacy work. So we'll do work in Congress and the administration and state capitals and city halls across the country. We do a lot of habitat restoration work on the ground, restore things like the Great Lakes and the incredible, you know, lake country in Wisconsin. And then we also do a lot in schools. We're in more than 15,000 schools where we provide curriculum, support teachers, in some cases have our great, we call it our Eco Schools program, and our Ranger Rick curricula, as a way to get more youth exposed to the outdoors, exposed to nature, and also have it be a way that they can retain a little bit more as they're learning science, technology, engineering, and math. So it's really a bunch of different fronts where we try to advance our mission.
And what is the relationship between the national office, if you will, the national organization, and its various affiliates in the 50 states?
So the affiliates are independent organizations, but we kind of come together. I joke with some folks, it's a little like NATO, where we will come together trying to find common ground, sometimes to play defense if there's things that we're concerned about or to try to advance policies that we think are necessary. And so, one of the great partnerships right now is trying to secure more additional federal funding for the recovery of species at the state level. And so trying to have more resources available. We do a pretty good job in this country funding the species we hunt and fish. We don't spend quite as much on the rest of wildlife, whether that's, pollinators like bees or, monarch butterflies or songbirds, a whole range of aquatic species that aren't fished as well. And so we're working together on like a bill called the Recovering America's Wildlife Act. The state voices are incredibly important, where we kind of come together kind of in that collective effort to try to move big things at the national and federal level.
You mentioned the fact that this is an organization that strives to reach across party lines. How difficult is it to do that, to function in that fashion, given kind of the overall political climate of our country, which is so sharply divided? Do you find that, by and large, this is an area of concern in which that kind of bipartisan work and cooperation is possible?
Yeah, I mean, the last few years have shown that, conservation and kind of investments in natural resources can be pretty bipartisan. I mean, there's big disagreements. I won't kind of pretend there aren't on some of the regulatory pieces and, things that different federal agencies are doing or state agencies. But I think on the investment side, we have seen this great level of bipartisanship. Last year, there was a bill called the Great American Outdoors Act, and it fully and permanently funded the Land and Water Conservation Fund, which is like the primary program to create state parks and expand national parks and national refuges, national wildlife refuges. And it also funded about almost $10 billion worth of deferred maintenance in our national parks and national wildlife refuges and our BLM lands out west and our Forest Service lands. And it was completely bipartisan. It was one of the big historic wins, and it was equally supported by Republicans and Democrats. It was signed into law by President Trump. And so there's these moments, right? I mean, there's not agreement on the best way to address climate change on the regulatory side. I mean, there's not agreement on some other issues, but I think like the wildlife bill I mentioned, the Recovering America's Wildlife Act, which is completely bipartisan. It's got 14 Senate Republicans and 14 Senate Democrats. There's something about, the outdoors, our wildlife, our parks, that can still bring people together despite the incredibly fractured politics that, unfortunately, is the reality right now in Washington.
One thing I read on your website, that is the National Wildlife Federation's website, which is nwf.org, is that you are very proud of the relationships that you have fostered with a plethora of valuable partners. The website makes reference to some 2,500 different organizations with which the NWF cooperates and collaborates. Can you help us understand what kind of organizations are valuable partners in the work that you do?
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm just constantly blown away by is the quality of nonprofit organizations across the country that are trying to do this work. And, some are focused on an individual stream in a community. Some are focused on, big regional ecosystems. Some are focused on certain education programs. Some are trying to address, longstanding environmental challenges in communities. And what we often try to do is try to find, try to provide linkages between different groups that are maybe working on the same issue in the same region, and try to build power that way. And a great example of that is something called the Healing Our Waters Coalition, which is a coalition of hundreds of groups across the Great Lakes. So bringing together folks from from Erie, Pennsylvania, all the way over to Minnesota, And obviously Wisconsin's got a big piece of this puzzle as well, trying to find places, but trying to have folks working together to advocate for bigger regional solutions. And there's something called the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative that was started, I guess, during the Obama administration. It started actually teed up during kind of the Bush administration and kind of enacted during the Obama administration. But these hundreds of groups, you know, came together working across the region, working with businesses, working with local elected officials. I'm trying to make the case that the Great Lakes was worthy of dedicated investment, a kind of specific investment to try to do restoration projects. And, you know, in one place, maybe Asian carp, in some place else, it might be, you know, algal blooms, in some place else, it may be zebra mussels, I mean, different kinds of projects. But, you know, trying to lift up groups that individually, you know, would have a hard time moving the, you know, kind of the needle in Congress, but together they have incredible power. And so, you know, we just try to be a convener and really try to show, you know, kind of connect dots and show how different groups, you know, by working together, that we get, you know, we get further. And there's that great proverb that, you know, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. And we really try to live by that, by, you know, kind of a servant leadership model. We can, you know, help bring groups together and then lift up their voices in D.C. to do big things together. Mm-hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Colin O'Mara. He is president and CEO of the National Wildlife Federation. We're going to be talking now about some provisions in the infrastructure bill, in the Build Back Better Act, that relate to climate and thus relate to some of the central concerns of the National Wildlife Federation. Mr. O'Mara, maybe we can just begin with that, first of all, that there is a connection there that probably some people might not fully appreciate or be aware of between climate and wildlife. How is it that an organization devoted to wildlife is concerned about climate? What is the connection there?
And right now, about one-third of all wildlife species in the U.S. are at heightened risk of extinction. And it's, you know, it's primarily, like I said, species we don't hunt and fish. And a large part of it is habitat loss. You know, we've built millions of miles of roads, and we've, you know, bisected habitat and kind of degraded it for different reasons. You know, just as the populations, you know, exploded over the last half century. But we're also seeing, you know, pretty big changes on the ground, on the landscape. And, you know, for those of your listeners that are, you know, that are in farming or, you know, other types of outdoor activities, outdoor industries, you know, I think most folks would acknowledge that things are changing pretty quickly on the landscape. And so, you know, wildlife, just like people, are affected by things like drought, things like, you know, kind of extreme weather events, whether that's, you know, greater levels of precipitation or, you know, hurricanes in the southeast, or, you know, flooding in the Midwest, or you know, the horrific fires that we're seeing in the far west. And, you know, species are dynamic. You know, they can adapt to a lot of changes. But as we're seeing, you know, kind of big temperature swings, in some cases we're seeing, you know, less water available because of drought conditions. In some cases we're seeing these horrific fires that are really altering the ecosystems. And fire is natural, but the fires that we're seeing are horrific in some ways. You know, so hot that they're burning, you know, habitat to a crisp, to the point where there's, you know, very little to grow back and have that kind of natural succession that we often see. And so the implications for wildlife are pretty significant. And when you layer on top, you know, warmer temperatures leading to, you know, greater populations of, you know, mosquitoes or, you know, other species that can be somewhat predatory in their nature. The implications of wildlife are pretty dramatic. And so, you know, we often say that, you know, when we save wildlife, we save ourselves. And so the same things that are good for us to try to mitigate the impacts of these more extreme swings that we're seeing are also going to be beneficial to the wildlife that we all care about. Hmm.
I was intrigued by the term climate forward, that you are coming out in favor of several climate-forward provisions of the package. Can you just take us inside that terminology of climate-forward?
Sure. So the idea is to, there's that great Wayne Gretzky quote about, you know, one of the reasons that he's, you know, the greatest is that he talked about skating where the puck was going as opposed to where it was. And, you know, one of the things that we're seeing as we're trying to reduce emissions is that, you know, laying a foundation that encourages the private sector and companies and governments to make investments that are looking forward, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, is one of the most cost-effective and ecologically effective ways to combat climate change. And so, you know, one of the things that we've been focused really heavily on is that a lot of the climate conversations of the past were fairly regulatory in the solution set. And, you know, we've been advocating for several years that a incredibly effective strategy would be to focus on investments and really trying to, you know, leverage private capital. I'm really trying to, you know, move markets, kind of pulling forward, kind of pulling into the future by incentivizing this kind of great action all across the country. Because I'm convinced when, you know, America puts its mind to something, there's no stopping us. And we've seen this, you know, repeatedly throughout our history. And so in the Build Back Better plan, you know, we've been kind of encouraging these types of, you know, climate forward investments that would really try to unleash just unbelievable amounts of innovation and entrepreneurship and action and construction, and also creating, you know, millions of construction jobs, you know, all across the country as a way to mobilize. And, you know, there's some precedent, right? When you look at, you know, the mobilization around World War II, when you look at, you know, kind of the build out of the middle class after in the 1950s, you know, there's these kind of very visionary, you know, goals and you know, objectives that were set, but there's also, you know, a significant amount of investment to try to make that vision a reality, or trying to replicate those successes here.
One of the proposals that you are in support of involves one facet of our energy world that I don't think a lot of us give much thought to, namely transmission lines. And apparently one possible provision of the Build Back Better Act will be tax credits that will support investment in upgrading and expanding transmission lines in the United States, transmission lines for energy. Describe what these transmission lines are and why there is upgrading that needs to happen, in your opinion.
Yeah, I appreciate the question. I mean, I think right now there's, you know, as much as 30% of the electricity we generate, you know, from a power plant or a renewable energy system can be lost along from the point where it's kind of, when the point where it's generated to the point it winds up in your home or your business, because we just have an old system. It's very inefficient, and it can be a lot smarter. It can, you know, we're going to need to increase capacity too, as we're, you know, increasing generation of electricity for things like, you know, electric vehicles and other uses. But, you know, we have a system that repeatedly fails in different parts of the country. We see it in, you know, in the West when things get too hot. We've had issues with, you know, transformers actually melting in some cases. I mean, like the rubber kind of protective systems melting, causing shorts. And a lot of the infrastructure at this point is 50, 60, 70 years old. And so this idea of both modernizing the grid so it's smarter, so you can dispatch energy more efficiently, so you reduce the losses, so you can kind of get power where it needs to be, and also having it connected to the system, the energy production of the future. A lot of the infrastructures, and it's unfortunately kind of in places where it's maybe not as necessary as in some places where there's been more population growth. But it's a way to really kind of move into the 21st century and make sure that we have clean, affordable, reliable energy for everyone in the country. And so trying to incentivize that is an important way to do it. And it's part of a bigger suite of investments. You know, we're trying to also make sure that investments, of course, in things like solar and wind are prioritized, but also things like geothermal energy, both for heating and cooling, as well as potentially some generation. Things like energy efficiency. We can save a lot of money if we are just more efficient with our appliances, our lighting, our heating and cooling. We can reduce a lot of pollution and save money at the same time. You know, we're also trying to make sure that, you know, that there's kind of next generation technologies around like carbon capture. This idea of capturing carbon that's coming off, you know, fossil fuel plants or manufacturing facilities before it goes into the atmosphere. So you keep our, you know, kind of our strong manufacturing base, but you're also reducing the pollution from those facilities. You know, also things like energy storage. You know, right now, you know, some of the renewable energy sources are a little more intermittent than like a coal plant or a fossil fuel plant. continue to be able to store power, you know, say from a solar system, you know, store power that you generate during the day so you can use the power, you know, at night across this smarter grid. And so there's a lot of different pieces that we're pretty excited about, that we think that, you know, by using really strategic incentives, that we can spur more innovation and more investment than you would if it was strictly a regulatory approach. Hmm.
You've anticipated one of my questions, which was, when it comes to this matter of energy storage, and again, just to be clear, we're talking about something like wind power or solar power, where it doesn't necessarily work around the clock, and so you need to have the capacity to store the energy that has been generated, so then you can utilize it when you need to, when the sun goes down or the wind dies down or whatever. Do we have the technology for the kind of energy storage that we need, or when we're talking about investment in energy storage, is it about developing new technologies around energy storage so we can accomplish this better, or is it just a matter of expanding what already exists?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. There's some technologies that are readily available, are kind of commercially available right now. I'd like to see some greater innovation in the space to get to scale, so we can have, you know, solutions that are kind of at the utility scale or at kind of the grid level. You know, I mean, some folks have different types of storage units. If they have solar systems, I mean, they're smaller battery kind of technology that we have right now. And a lot of the early hybrid cars, like the Prius or some of the electric vehicles, have storage, you know, capacity inside their batteries as a way to kind of dispatch power when you need it. And so, like, those technologies have been around for many years. I think what we're working on now is trying to get to, like, the next level of, you know, kind of utility scale. So when you're talking about, you know, projects of, you know, tens or even hundreds of megawatts of clean energy, you know, that could power, you know, tens of thousands of homes or hundreds of thousands of homes, having the storage capacity for that. And, you know, we worked really hard in a bipartisan way a few years ago, just trying to, again, provide additional incentives for the deployment of these technologies. Because one of the concerns that, you know, we hear from time to time is that, you know, the renewable energy sources like solar and wind and geothermal aren't as reliable as some of the baseload, whether that's nuclear or natural gas or coal-fired plants. And, there's some truth to that, right? I mean, the sun obviously generates a lot more during the day than generate at night. And so the solution there is having both, you know, kind of smart grid as well as storage. And so as we're working to reduce emissions from the fossil fuel power plants, we're also, you know, bringing more and more renewables online. And we think it's that mix of having, you know, as clean as possible on the renewables and on the fossil fuel side, combined with renewables that are backed up by storage, is going to be the way we have to achieve the three goals of having, you know, cleaner, more reliable, and cheaper energy in the future. Hmm.
Finally, I want to ask you about the matter of clean manufacturing. And I think maybe a couple of the matters that you've already mentioned probably kind of fall under that umbrella, or are to some extent related to it. But what else needs to be done in terms of making our manufacturing sector a sort of cleaner operating function?
Yeah, this is I think the one of the most important facets of the climate debate right now, because I do think in the past we haven't focused enough on making sure we're making things in America. And you have great manufacturers all across the state of Wisconsin, you know, that are in different supply chains and you know, different industries. Right now about 21% of all emissions come from the industrial sector. That's largely, you know, steel mills, cement plants, folks that are making things like aluminum or different kinds of plastics or, you know, kind of products from petrochemicals. And, you know, frankly, I mean, I want those things made in America. I'm tired of buying goods from China. You know, we saw the consequences of, you know, having China control so many supply chains during the pandemic when we couldn't get protective equipment. And I'm tired of our dollars going overseas. And so there's a real effort right now to try to have, you know, more domestic manufacturing, but let's, you know, do it in cleaner ways. At the same time, you know, we're seeing, you know, countries like China invest a lot in renewable energy manufacturing. And so, you know, we want to make sure that, you know, we provide the incentives and the business conditions to try to have more of that manufacturing here. You know, I don't want to spend the next, you know, 30 years buying, you know, solar panels from China or I don't know, electric vehicles from Japan, or, you know, offshore wind turbines, or, you know, wind turbines from Germany. You know, I want as much of that made here in America as possible. And so there's kind of two sets of incentives. There's one, it's Section 40C of the tax code. Everything in the federal government is so complicated. There's a whole different language down there, down in the swamp. But the this idea would be to try to really incentivize the manufacturing of clean energy technologies here by providing incentives that would reduce the cost of new facilities and new equipment as really a way to encourage more investment here at home. And then there's a complementary set of investments that would help underwrite the cost of pollution controls. So if folks wanted to try to have, you know, carbon capture technologies or really a whole suite of technologies that would reduce the amount of pollution going in the air, they could actually get compensated for the tons of pollution that they save. And this would allow plants, you know, in Wisconsin or in places like northern Indiana or in Illinois that, you know, could really compete with some of their global competitors. And right now, I mean, it's just not a level playing field, right? I mean, so many American manufacturers manufacture their good that with much less pollution than we're seeing from, you know, in factories in China or India or, you know, other places around the world. And yet, you know, they're competing in the same marketplace. Hmm. So, you know, they're often paying better wages. They're, you know, they're meeting better environmental standards, yet they're still trying to sell in a, you know, kind of in a global market. And so, you know, we've been encouraging both the Trump administration and the Biden administration to take a look at leveling that playing field also with imports. Letting American manufacturers compete. And, you know, it may be funny for, you know, a wildlife guy to be talking about the economics of all this, but, you know, I feel strongly that, you know, we can do it better and cleaner here in the U.S. and that the pollution we see coming from other parts of the world could frankly be reduced if we, you know, held folks accountable for the pollution they're having and have them meet similar standards to what we're meeting in the U.S. And so, you know, there's a lot of job opportunities. I mean, the energy economy globally is, you know, in the tens of trillions of dollars. And so there's huge opportunities for businesses to, you know, be innovating or manufacturing or constructing or deploying or operating these systems. I mean, we anticipate there could be, you know, tens of millions of jobs created in the years ahead. You know, and I just want to make sure they're made here. I'm not just sending, you know, harder money here overseas to buy knockoff goods that aren't usually of the same quality as things that are made in America.
If any of our listeners share your concerns about some of these issues that we've been discussing over the last few minutes, what would you suggest they do? I mean, is this as simple a matter as the proverbial call your congressman, or are there other things you would want people to do?
Yeah, I mean, and it really is. I mean, not to, it's kind of a cliche at this point, but, you know, I think, you know, calling your member of Congress, the Wisconsin delegation matters a lot in this conversation. The folks like Tammy Baldwin and Ron Kind and others that, you know, are in the, on the right committees, and then they've all been, you know, huge advocates of Wisconsin and making sure that there's more jobs and that we make climate investments in ways that are smart for both the economy and the environment, that we don't have to choose one over the other. But, you know, if you've been concerned about some of the heat waves and you know, drought conditions and, you know, some of the flooding we've seen in some parts of the state, if you're interested in the business opportunities that could come from, you know, the transition to cleaner sources of energy, if you're interested in the investments around our natural resources and trying to, you know, restore, you know, these kind of great outdoor systems that, you know, reduce some of those impacts I just talked about, but also just provide, you know, great outdoor places and support a lot of jobs, just let them know. Let your local member of Congress know that you're supportive of the Build Back Better plan, that you want to see strong, you know, kind of common sense climate provisions that are part of that, and that that's important to you. And I think if you do that, it matters a lot. And it really does make a difference when folks hear from people directly. There's so many, you know, there's so many suits in D.C. and everything else, you know, walking around. But when they hear from folks back home, that's when it really makes a difference, because it shows that it matters to people.
Once again, the website for the National Wildlife Federation is nwf.org, and their president and CEO, Colin O'Mara. Mr. O'Mara, thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Greg, thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear my conversation with Leonard... Leonard Rosenstein, the author of a book called Perilous Medicine, which talks about the difficulty in safeguarding healthcare and healthcare workers in times of war and in so-called zones of war, a challenge which has only become more difficult in recent years with such a fundamental change in how our wars are waged. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived.